a natural fiction. This decision is your heads to decide. And if it does, you will...
Hi, this is Bill from Bristol, PA. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
You're listening to Quintron's Weather Warlock. Live stream of an analog drone synthesizer played by the weather, made by the New Orleans-based artist Quintron. Listen to the Quintron Weather Warlock take the changes in weather at Wave Farm in Greene County and hear it anytime, 24 hours a day at wavefarm.org/listen, or go to any WGXC.org webpage and click on the listen button to hear Quintron's Weather Warlock turning the changes in precipitation and sunlight and wind and temperature into sound.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. You are listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, in the name of the show. Good night, Norman. Tonight, besides weird brief feedback loops, I'm going to read from Ed Sanders' Tales of Beatnik Glory. Ed Sanders. It's easy enough to look up. I'm not going to tell you anything about his biography. You can find out. I'm just here to read his fiction. And this first story from Tales of Beatnik Glory, actually published in 1975, is called Total Assault Cantina. I'm writing this from the Valley of Shrieks and the Alleys of Despair. The cellar in which I live is damp. Brown roaches shine on the wall post in the candle glare. I am sleeping on a bunch of rags, bundled up in buttoned, despicable shirts like rag torsos, 8 of them, my bed. The food which I consume is garbage. Occasionally, I go to the bread line. As I write, I look about me and see nothing to which to look for specks of hope. I hook the newspapers, wet with slime and yellowed with egg, from the garbage. Cans, and when they are dry, I lie down on my floor to read them. That was like bad punctuation, sorry. Anyways, and I am disgusted. I'm disgusted by bad punctuation. Okay. And there is nothingness. No rungs in the ladder of whiteness, for no longer is there any ladder, but only two poles remain. the rungs are shattered, and the poles are used upon the shoulders of mourners to carry the dangling bodies of defeat home to squalor. My landlord is a verminous crook. He raises the rent on my cellar without mercy. May he die in rush hour traffic. No, may he live. I don't care. It don't care. The Milky Way is nothing to know. The floodlights of the concentration camp have not yet flooded through the windows of my wet cellar, and I don't care. Grex is the Latin word for herd. Grex, hex, sex, spex, flex. I have thought about crawling about or crumbling supine, maybe strapping roller skates to my forearms and shins and scuttling thus, beating the pavement with small boards. But they would put me away. They might. And I remember well what Judith Malina told me so many years ago. Never do it alone. Always conspire. I want to describe for you my cellar, for I have memorized it, and the Xerox-like replica of it in my mind is just enough removed from reality that I can bounce fondness beams upon the page in contemplation of its image. It is dirty, wet, shiny with roaches. The two windows are narrow, located at the top of the front wall. They look like small New York curbside sewer grates. I can hear the feet stomping my metal doors, and if I stand on my chair, I can watch the legs walk by. To garner warmth, I merely open the furnace room door, and a humming breeze lightly cuts the chill. There is nothing to report about the floor, other than when the concrete was poured, no one bothered to scrape it to a level condition. It is blobby, wavy, stinky with 50 years of coal dust and blotched with the garbage of my forays. I was once a rising author. The reviewers used to look forward to reading my quote-unquote next novel. My creations are on my cellar shelf. I had not much to say other than to urge the rebels to stand up in the slice lines, take it, struggle. And now, rotting spring binders hold the cobweb-streaked pages of my youth. What was it? It was a bitter mingling, brothers and sisters, and time is not the guide. Quiet despair, quiet desperation, quiet. I screamed till they knelt down to look through the slits into the cellar. Then I lay still. Maybe I shall walk to the New York Public Library to continue my all-important 10-year research into narco-hypno-robo-wash. It doesn't matter, for I am sorting through my files. And as soon as I have them thoroughly ordered, I shall find a university to accept them, and maybe then I shall eat grass and live upon the roadsides of America, a plastic container with a moldy spoon of potato salad here, a plastic container with a leftover onion ring, a small untouched ketchup pouch there. This is what I tell myself. Then we shall roll, brothers and sisters, then we shall hear the trumpeteers and saxophones again. There is a purple grape shining between the thumb and forefinger of Dionysius. There is an olive in the fist of Demeter. But in the fist of the monster on the front page is the sigil of robot war. I am grunged upon by that monster and sorely affrighted. There is an ancient bale of hay down here in my cellar, black and greasy with grime. But the baling wire still holds it together. This hay has been here for 12 years, ever since 1961. I laugh whenever I sit upon it to read. For it reminds me of the Total Assault Cantina, and of the time 12 years ago we threw a bunch of rifles into the East River that had been smuggled into the U.S. by a gang of right-wing creeps. Ha ha ha! Now that was a caper. You see, the cantina was located on the floor right above the cellar where I now dwell. That is to say, on Avenue A at 11th Street. Don't bother to look for the remains of Total Assault Cantina now, for the building had been burnt out for years. After the cantina folded, the mafia used the place for years to store jukeboxes. Then they set fire to the place in an insurance scam. We were crazed with the strange release granted to us by the civilization. LSD was years away for us, but already we were driven specks of foment. We were walking ergo, but no one was so driven with urgency in those days as the proprietors of Total Assault Cantina. They felt the need. They burned to struggle for the socialist revolution. They beat their fists into their palms, considering ways to further the nonviolent struggle. Both were in their early 20s at the time. Both had grown up in New York City. John McBride was thin, nervous, with a thick red mustache and short red-brown hair. Paul Stillman was more relaxed, meditative, with his hair drawn back and knotted behind him. Together, John and Paul operated the Total Assault, a non-profit establishment intensely dedicated toward yanking the corpses of J.P. Morgan's neo-Confederates through the amphetamine piranha tank. It was just that way. Their agitation kept them walking acrobatic along that perilous thin path of roach clips, one side of which lay Gandhian ahimsa, the other side bitter street battles and the violent insurgency of a potential New York commune. The personalities of the two operators of Total Assault whirled in intellectual combat on the question of tactics. Both wanted to crash that TV tower off the top of the Empire State, but their approaches were somewhat different. It was sort of anarcho-Mao versus anarcho-Dao. The Buddha, Buddha, Buddha of machine gun fire for John became Buddha, Buddha pacing rebels for Paul. Both were convinced for the time being, however, that non-violent direct street action was the correct way to proceed. The first cafe they had operated was a tiny place on 9th Street, between B and C. They called it Cantina de las Revoluciones. They managed to float for about a year before poverty and debt forced it to close. Then they located a much larger space on Avenue A and 11th Street, comprising a whole ground floor with a courtyard. The rent, $100 a month. It was eternity. I'm just going to interject here that $100 a month was a lot to pay for a storefront in 1961, I tell you now. Imagine. It wasn't long before the license inspectors came around, and that meant instant trouble because John and Paul did not cooperate with the concept of licensing. "We're going to close you down," the inspectors told them. "Can't sell food without a license."
"Yeah, we're revolutionaries. Taxes don't exist. The Department of Licenses doesn't exist. Why don't you sit down and help us with the 12-cent soup?"
But the licensiers gave them a summons and would not help with the circle of friends peeling vegetables for the Gandhian ambrosia. Soon they were forced to trek down to the Department of Licenses to fill out the forms. They wanted to call the restaurant Cafe Hashish, a proposal that was immediately banned by the red tapers.
"We're going to the Civil Liberties Union to see about this, you fucking fascist,"
Paul snorted after a long argument with the officials of the department, but there was nothing to be done. A few days later, they tried again. They were ushered into the office of Mr. William Karkenschul, Deputy Director of Licenses, Liberal Party appointee, a human who was at that time trying to close down coffee houses which offered poetry readings. Mr. Karkenschul read from the notarized business form.
"Let's see, mumble mumble, John Z. McBride and Paul A. Stillman, DBA, Vomit A Restaurant."
Karkenschul stared at the two.
"You mean you want to start a restaurant called Vomit?"
A slight curl of revulsion lifting his lip.
"First you come in here last week trying to name your dive with an illegal name, and now it's Vomit. Is this some sort of game?"
"Look here, Karko, we want to call it Vomit. Now what about it?"
"It cannot be allowed," he replied. "The public won't stand for it." Well, how about the Gargantua House of Puke, Paul sneered. That suggestion got them thrown out of the office. You, Mr. Liberal Party Poetry Banner, you show us the regulation that says we can't call our restaurant cafe hashish or vomit or anything we want.
A few days later, they were back at the Department of Licenses with a name that sailed through the bureaucratic ocean. Total Assault Cantina. The license department blitzed them repeatedly. They seemed to inspect them once a week. I had a friend that brought the cantina a station wagon full of hot cigarettes from South Carolina once a month. They were almost caught by the license creeps who certainly would have snitched John and Paul out to the feds. We carried the tax stampless cigs down into the cellar in the nick of time. As it was, the licensoids required John and Paul to obtain what was called a license to act as retail dealer in cigarettes in the city of New York. When they began to hold poetry readings, Karkenschul picked up the announcements of the readings from the Village Voice and sent raiders out to issue summonses, informing the two that they'd have to cringe and beg for a cabaret license if they wanted to continue poetry. There was a law in New York that allowed entertainment in a restaurant by no more than 3 stringed instruments and a piano, allowing no poetry and no singing. Otherwise, a cabaret license was necessary, a bureaucratic nightmare involving bribing building inspectors and requiring employees to register with the fuzz and to carry cabaret ID cards and so forth. Another thing that pissed off the authorities was that Total Assault was unable to resist allowing people to sleep on the floor, although it drove the landlord nuts. The police would shine flashlights through the front window in the middle of the night, and the floor looked like a packed meadow of sleeping bags. Crashers could only cop about 6 hours sleep, however, because John and Paul had to wake everybody up by 10 a.m. in order to sweep and get the breads in the ovens in time to open for the noon hour soup rush. Total Salt was more of a community center than a mere cafe. A bougaz across the room revealed a kitchen containing a quaking Salvation Army icebox, a huge oven, storage cabinets made of packing crates, and a long varnished pine serving counter. There was a whole wall devoted to collages and bulletins, leaflets, and the like, and in the back near the courtyard was a printing press area marked off by beautiful black Chinese screens, the origin of which Ta only knows. There was another wall crammed with bookshelves, the people's library, as John called it, out of which the people steadily drained the books, never to return. There were numerous found-in-street divans placed around a large central table for those who liked to dine, reclining. The walls were spotted with can lids nailed over rat holes. The more serious breaches were sealed off with a mixture of Brillo pads and plaster. Near the front window was an old upright piano, stacked atop which was a neat pyramid of sleeping bags for the nighttime mattress meadow. With regard to the wall devoted to leaflets and collages, by the end of a year there were maybe 1,000 leaflets now overdubbed upon old. New overdubbed upon old, from floor to ceiling. In my cellar I have a box containing all the posters and stuff from that wall. Come out and get me. New York Graphic Society. Meetings. They may have held 100 meetings a month at Total Assault. They held a New York Times sneer in every night at 7 p.m., where everybody took turns singing and declaiming articles from that day's edition, accompanied by great jeers, chortles, and spits of anger. The 10 top stock advances of the day were soundly jeered, and when the market went down a few points, there was a tumult of applause. Sometimes, when the market really went bad, Paul would put up a sign in the window announcing the good news. I used to love the town meetings on Tuesday nights. There were wonderful shouting matches, and many a grandiose scheme was hatched in the air. A free medical and dental clinic was born out of these meetings and still thrives, but much of it was kiosk of ego babble, though I got to practice my yodeling a lot when the debates grew laborious. In spite of the good Dharma Kami Karma, the cantina was a fiscal disaster. There was a prophetic sign above the cash register reading, "There will be no profit." The biggest money drain was the food scroungers. There was a porcelain bathtub in the window in which John and Paul created a huge daily vegetable salad. Next to it was a crock of free tea and another crock of soup. People seemed to drift in the door with glazed eyes like food robots and would serve themselves from the salad tub and soup crock. Then there would rise the quick slurps of filling stomachs, after which they vanished without paying. There were so many hungry, but there were a lot of people with plenty of cash lining up for free food also. I must confess that I too, shekels clanking in my pockets, ripped free hunks of rye and bowls of soup from Total Assault Cantina. At first they tried to hand customers chits, but these were left damp upon the tables or used to wipe up spills. Each day John and Paul cooked fresh bread. Humans began to steal whole loaves. They would saunter in, order coffee, and whistle out the door with a loaf, and on the way home from work at that. The cantina was written up in one of the Sunday magazine supplements as being a, quote, groovy place to get delicious free food, end quote. That nearly caused a riot. People were driving in from New Jersey to score free beatnik chow. There were hundreds lining the sidewalk and packed inside. That's where John and Paul should have cleaned up. Maybe giving a little free soup and charging for everything else. As it was, people were spilling into the printing area where I was working, and it pissed me off because we were trying to print some draft cards and fake ID for draft resistors at the time. So to put an end to the weekender spew, we printed up a disgusto menu featuring things like eyeballs au gratin and frogani skewered on toothpicks. And we taped 10 or 15 copies on the cantina windows facing up. Then we filled the salad bathtub with a concoction of Martian cookie toss that was genuinely disgusting. We cut the heads off a few dozen realistic rubber snakes and plopped them in the gruel, adding doll heads, weeds from the park, a couple of rats with a sign taped to the tub, "Free." I ran the print shop where we specialized in protest posters, poetry mags, draft cards, IDs, and leaflets. I worked hard, and they would come in from the streets to babble in my ears for hours as I zombie stood at the press. Strange people with involved tales. There were those who insisted that immediately I drop everything and print a book of their verse, or a resume, or 6 years of diaries depicting their experiments in Zen Sufi trance dance in Arabia Petra. I was even supposed to pay for the paper. Then I got into trouble with one of the local street gangs. I forget their name. Maybe the Face Axers, something like that. They really got angry. I wouldn't let them use the print shop toolkit to work on their zip guns. That night, the front window was caved in. There was no money to fix it and certainly no insurance, so it was a find boards in the street scene. About this time, there was some sort of drug panic, and the junkies stooped so low as to rob Total Assault. They stole 15 tuned gongs belonging to the Celestial Freak Beam Orchestra. They stole the electric soup heater from the front window. They stole my electric typewriter, but left the offset. Probably it was too heavy for them. When they raided late at night, they were surprised encountering the zing mattress meadows, so they tied and gagged 11 people and left them zipped up in their sleeping bags. In a further dour overdub, the phone was stumped after a so-called friend made a 4-hour call to London and didn't tell anyone about it. Poverty was imminent. John and Paul tallied their main debts. Gas, electric, $60. Paper, $80. Lumber, $160. 2 months' rent, $200. Food, $200. Now, how are we gonna make $700, man? Well, I hope it's not gonna be a Times Square ankle grab scene, joked Sam. They held an emergency hookah side scheme session. First, they contemplated the traditional Brentano's art book ripoff scam. But who could carry $700 worth of Skira in New York Graphic Society publications? Next, they seriously considered a nonviolent bank robbery. They spent considerable time trying to compose a note to be handed to the teller, which A, would reassure the teller, B, would in fact cause the teller to fork over the money, C, would not result in their immediate arrest. But there was just no way nonviolently to rob a bank. One thing they did do right away was to hold a benefit poetry reading, one of those 8 p.m. till 4 a.m. versathons where 37 poets sat nervously waiting to read. That raised a punkly $75, although it was a great thronging social success. Someone left a flute packed to the mouthpiece with amphetamine under a table, which they quickly sold, and the night's take was up to $110. They thought of selling the printing equipment, but why have a revolutionary cantina if you can't print? The next afternoon, John called his aunt in the Bronx. The family had a produce business at the Hunts Point Market, where Total Assault had managed to run up a sizable bill. John wanted to hustle a few more weeks of food stuff from his aunt, and in the course of the conversation, she told him, "Larry's in from Hong Kong. He's been trying to get in touch with you. He wants to talk to you about something." Larry's in from Hong Kong meant there was dope around. Her cousin Larry regularly brought in lots of hash and grass when his ship returned to New York. Aunt Mildred gave him the number and a balking approval for vegetable credit. John called Larry right away. "You got any hamburger, man?" "You bet I have," Larry replied. "Listen, I've been trying to get in touch with you for 3 days. I'm in a desperate situation. Can we meet?" Larry grabbed a subway to the Lower East Side and conferred at Total Assault, offering a deal that would save it. If John and Paul would store 10 100-pound bags of compressed grass for 1 week, Larry and his confederates would pay them $1,000. "Whoopee!" Paul shouted. "Ra is hip to us." "There was a foul-up," Larry told them, "down in Memphis, and they can't pick it up till next week. I have some other deliveries to make, and I just can't wait around in New York. Where am I going to put it? Dad's potato bins at the market?" The deal was simple. All John and Paul had to do was to hold the dope safe and dry until a certain individual would drive up in a red van and announce himself with the code phrase, "Agnus Dei." With an ahem, Paul asked for a small advance against the $1,000, and cousin Larry forked over $200. Late that night, trembling with paranoia, they unloaded the heavy bags down into the cellar beneath the cantina. A few hours later, Paul began to swear that he could smell pot fumes oozing up through the rather open floorboards. Maybe it was paranoia, but John and Paul both soon thought the pot smell was overpowering. Early the next day, they borrowed a truck and drove out to New Jersey, where they bought a few bales of hay, which they placed in the cantina as sofas, hoping the hay fumes would cover for the grass. For double protection, they picked up some 100-pound sacks of flour, pinto beans, and peanuts, which they lugged down to the cellar to cover the sacks of dope. Exactly a week later, a man appeared and said, "Hi, I'm Agnus Dei." It was broad daylight. Paul threw up his hands and said, "You mean we have to load up the hamburger in daylight in front of a street full of people?" "No," laughed Agnus Dei. "I'll be back at 1 a.m. And so, by dark of night, they loaded the half ton of grass into the red panel truck. Talk about fear. They scanned the streets again and again. Each passing auto was the feds. Footsteps were cop steps. They frenzy finished the job in about 2 minutes flat. The man handed them their $800. "You see that box?" The man winked. They looked into the van and saw a packing crate behind a partition. "Made in Hong Kong" was stenciled on the side. "Well, yeah, what's that?" There's 50 automatic rifles in there for the Operation Thunder people. Operation Thunder was a racist right-wing paramilitary outfit in the Midwest that operated in the early 60s, late 60s, later branching out into political assassinations. They're paying us $100 apiece. John and Paul looked at each other. Paul asked, how are you going to get the weapons to them? I don't know nothing. All I know is I'm supposed to park this van at 23rd and 7th Avenue and leave it overnight. The Thunderbolts, or whatever they call themselves, they'll take care of the rest.
Let's steal the guns, Paul whispered as soon as the van had split. Yeah, let's dump them in the river, man. But how are we going to carry them? We can't load 50 machine guns into a cab.
Then they remembered the ancient pushcart outfitted with bicycle wheels that had been in the cellar when they first rented the place. They raised the iron cellar doors and grubbled in the boards and debris in the back and passageway till they found it. Forthwith, they trotted with the pushcart up to 23rd Street and 7th, where they found the van parked on the west side of the avenue. It was empty, except for the Hong Kong packing case. John smashed the back window and opened the door.
See if there's a toolkit in the front, man. Oh, yeah, here's one. Well, give me a pry bar.
They crowbarred the crate top open enough to see that there were, in fact, rifles inside, but the box was so heavy they couldn't even move it an inch. John stood on guard duty, keeping an eye out for the right-wing creeps. Paul removed the lid and started hooking out the greasy weapons.
What do we do with them, man?
John spotted a manhole cover right behind the panel truck. He pried away the cover and said,
here, in here, man. We'll dump some in here and cart the rest. Whatever we can carry, down to the river.
Paul handed out armloads of the weapons to John, who slid them down into the hole.
Make sure they're barreled down. We don't want the workmen to think that they might go off in their faces.
When they had thrown enough away so that they could budge the case, they oofed it out and onto the cart. They nailed the lid back on, and then it was a paranoid sprint to the east side. They raced to 23rd and Avenue C, then down C to 14th, then to 10th, hanging a left on 10th, and they hit Avenue D in a full panic gallop. Uh-oh, straight ahead was the East Side Highway. Zit, zit, the drunken midnighters whipped past. They grabbed the gun box and herniated the rifles across the lanes in a sweat bath scene. They dropped the box on the far side and raced back to the cart, carried it across and heaped the box back on it, frantically looking for an entrance to the park which lay between the highway and the river. They sped south and finally found a path. Oops, it dead-ended in a handball court.
We should have brought a flashlight, man,
Paul groaned, trying to stop the cart before it crashed into the wall. They spotted a murky opening that seemed to lead through a ball field with the river just a couple hundred feet away. Huffily, they pushed the cart through center field on the way to second, to home, to the dugout, and to a gate at the water's edge. Armload by armload, they hurled the rifles into the sewery East River. This done, they collapsed on the ball field. It was an hour before they could move. Far, far into the night they celebrated, heaping hookahs of praise upon their lungs, triumphant over the puny smugglers of the Order of Thunder. It was another year before the Total Assault Cantina went bye-bye with the waning desires of the proprietors to face the hassles. Paul left the city and now lived down in Arroyo Eternitas, New Mexico, whence he has sent back word that he expects to be reincarnated into a pine tree. John is still plus six, but he is caught in the knowledge that they send poets to insane asylums in Russia.
I know I won't be able to live in my own revolution, he wrote me the other day.
Myself, I began to live in the cellar several years after the mafia insurance fire. You might say I stumbled upon it. You see, I was working as a part-time research reporter, a stringer, they call it, for an uptown news mag. I was getting $100 for every report I filed, which was more than adequate at that time to provide me the leisure to finish that follow-up novel that the critics had assured me in their reviews they were eager to encounter. Anyway, one night I was out researching the post-hippie disaster area of the Lower East Side, you know, for one of those Where Have All the Flowers Gone articles. I was tottery drunk from investigation in Pee Wee's bar, and I staggered down Avenue A at 2 a.m. past the old Total Assault Cantina. John had told me that some of the hay from the grasscaper was still lying in the cellar, so I lifted the metal flaps, lit a match, and stumbled down the steps. Then I passed out, and so it was. I loved that friendly cellar. Once I had defeated the rats and the water bugs, I approached the landlord, who thought I was crazy, but gave it up for 55 a month. And I am still living here, probably even as you gaze. I am typing this account with my typewriter atop the hay bale from the past. But it is now my dinner time, and I am going to push up the metal flaps and emerge upon the street. Then it's off to the pizzeria on St. Mark's Place and the grovel at the source of sources, the white round-topped metal waste bin with the shiny aluminum flap that says push. The waste bin is always crammed with yummy eighths of pizza hunks smashed into those squares of greasy wax paper, not to mention an occasional tablespoon of grape drink hovering in a crushed cup. In fact, I'm usually dining from the pizza trash bin every evening about 6 o'clock. If any of you who used to hang out at Total Assault should care to drop by and nibble on the past. Oh, I would love to editorialize, but I'm not going to do that to you. There you go. All editorial observations. All right, this one is from the updated later edition of Tales of Beatnik Glory. This will be volume two's opening story. It's called, the opening story of volume two is called I Have a Dream. Some of them finally fell asleep, but most talked excitedly and every few minutes began singing, clapping, and stomping their feet through the long AM to DC. Over and over they sang the tunes that aroused them and gave melodies to their philosophical passions. If I Had a Hammer, Solidarity Forever, Ain't Gonna Study War No More, Dona Nobis Pacem. There was a boisterous contingent who led the bus in Kubasi Yankee No. We Shall Wear the Red and Black, and the Internationale, that fine song from the 1870 Paris Commune. Sam and his friends sat in the back where they passed reefers and alcohol back and forth discreetly till they were deposited in the morning, weary and hungry, at the edge of the park by the Washington Monument. Sam had something to do, so he waved at Cynthia, Talbot, and Nelson, then ran away. They were all to meet later under a certain elm tree to the right of Lincoln Memorial. Though it was 90 degrees, Sam sported double-thick, snake-proof, knee-high boots, an orangey herringbone riding jacket flared at the hips, a collarless tattersall shirt, and an Australian campaign hat tied to the side with a no-hope-without-dope pin. He worried about the pin and pulled it off, replacing it with a button marked Ahimsa. He also lugged a 16mm camera case and a satchel packed with the new issue of Dope, Fucking, and Social Change, a journal of the New America, which he'd stayed up printing till bus boarding time at 2 a.m. That's why he was tired. He was headed for the Library of Congress, a mile from the bus. "I'd like to take a look at the Ezra Pound broadcast," Sam Thomas said. His lungs felt like broken shards in a thermos from running the distance. They brought him a box of white-on-black copies, apparently copied from film negatives of transcripts of Pound's Italian broadcast from 1941 to 43, as recorded by the Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service. Sam was too excited to scan right away. His normal transition time for passing between agitation and calming down enough for scholarship was at least 10 minutes. Today he forced it, and his initial notes were wobbly and almost indecipherable. The research was into what Sam and a few pals called the LBQ, short for pound question. Not many people that Washington Day really thought much about LBQ, but to poets in the beat, Black Mountain objectivists, or deep image traditions, it was a serious problem. If eyes were sandpaper, Sam would have long ago erased the text in LB's collected earlier poems personae. His relentless scholarship, his mixture of tough and tender lyrics, his love of Greek and Latin helped Sam become a poet. For younger people, this LBQ is, LB is like the pound LB, like LB as an abbreviation, and the Q is for question. Ezra Pound was anything, well, he's probably gay, but he was also a Nazi. Anyways, after the war, that's what he's talking about. And, you know, it was a big thing for people back then. I don't know, I shouldn't explain this stuff. You should just find out yourself who Ezra Pound was. After the war, when Sam was in the first grade, LB had been indicted for treason, then placed in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in D.C. as bonkers. See, he was indicted for treason because he was a Nazi, but then, you know, all the poets and intellectuals felt bad for him, and so they put him in the nut house instead of prison. There had been a long debate among writers when Pound won the Bollingen Prize for the Faizan Cantos while he was in the asylum. Some said he'd been a traitor for his wartime broadcast. Others said he was a great poet and his poesy separated him from the broadcast. Others said he was a silly figment of prior times and should be forgotten. In 1963, at the time of the Great March on Washington, LB had long been de loony bend and was back in Italy. Had long been de loony bend and was back in Italy. Sam wanted to see for himself and spotted it almost at once. The texts were dotted with kikes, councils of kikes, and kikettes, which was LB's code for Roosevelt's cabinet. God, this motherfucker really was an anti-Sim, Sam blurted out a bit too loudly, causing the desk cat to lift his brows. A half hour was enough. Sam stood, dashed with the transcripts to the counter, thanked the librarian, shouldered his camera and the satchel of dope fucking and social change, a journal of the New America, and sprinted out of the Marble Data Center, past the Capitol, the National Gallery of Art, the Smithsonian, the White House, the Washington Monument, toward the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool. For some reason, he'd stashed a tab of mescaline in his boot. It melted and seeped through his sweaty socks into a popped blister so that he was picking up mild colors just as he arrived at the giant throng that crowded around Lincoln. Sam has never seen 200,000 people before. When he took out the bell and howl and started to film, he was aware of a low-pitched crackly noise that trembled from the multitude. It was Sam's first experience with mass demo buzz, which came not only from the crackly roar of the multitude, but also from hundreds at the edges, shout-talking for causes and distributing a vastness of leaflets, magazines, pennants, buttons, pamphlets, and broadsides for left, liberal left, civil rights, and peace groups. Sam loved it. It was like a mist of amphetamine hitting his senses. He did not realize that 15 years of demo buzzes lay before him. Nervous with friend-find angst, Sam was zigging and zagging through the bannered contingents looking for his friends. Joan Baez was on the stage just then, beginning We Shall Overcome, which in the summer of 1963 and the freshness of its acceptance as a national anthem could arouse like no other tune. He found his friends sharing lemonade by the big elm they called the Peace Tree, with its beautifully serrated leaves. He scooted next to his friend John Barrett, who, like Sam, had brought something he'd just created to the march, a tortoise-shell lyre copied from a Greek vase. I read some of the LB broadcast at the Library of Congress, he said, handing John his notes. John looked at them. No one can qualify as a historian of this half-century without having examined the protocols of the Elders of Zion, 4-2043, Talmudic Jews who want to kill off all the other races whom they cannot subjugate. 4-2042,
American lynch law had its origins in the Jewish ruin of the American South, 1642. If you don't find a leader, you may have to wait for some kind-hearted Bavarian or Hungarian to come free you from the Jews of New York, 3642. I said the Republicans would have all Kikeria, all the Kike prophets out against him in 1944, 3-16-43. For two centuries, ever since the brute Cromwell brought him back into England, the Kikes have sucked out your vitals, 3-15-42. The dregs of the ex-ghettos of Europe now plastered on the necks of the American people, 3-23-42. The USA will be no use to itself or to anyone else until it gets rid of the Kikes and Mr. Roosevelt, 3-11-42. Hitler, having seen the Jew puke in the Germany democracy, was out for responsibility, 4-20-42. John stopped reading because the page was shaking. These are all quotes from broadcasts? Sam nodded. He and John had thumbed back and forth across America earlier that summer, studying the cantos every morning before hitching in sessions they humorously referred to as round pounds. John tore and wadded the sheet, tossing it back to Sam. I think it was two people, Sam said, at least two people. He was a cracker from the anti-Sem heartland with a trigger temper and a mean streak, thick as a heel on a jackboot. And he was also a tender cat who could write exquisite Chinese nature poetry. Sam's blister gave him a full-color picture of Pound in the broadcast booth, his gnarly beard pressed up against one of those round microphones suspended within a circle of metal, ranting like a crazed hick. Pound was instantly forgotten when Talbot Jenkins joined the circle of Lower East Siders. Talbot was returning from the speaker's platform at the top of the front steps of the memorial. He was broad-shouldered, with a big head of hair, and eyelids that made his eyes seem to curve down at the outer edges. He was known among his friends as Talbot the Great because of years getting bashed, handcuffed, and cattle-prodded, integrating the South. Talbot the Great had grown up in Harlem, where his parents were minister and musical director of a church. He'd been a star fullback till the Freedom Rides of 61, when the Klan had attacked his bus as it pulled into Birmingham. One of them smashed Talbot's knee with a lead pipe, ending his football career. Even now, he limped slightly. Talbot intended to avoid Birmingham the rest of his life, but last spring, 2 years later, the call had gone out to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation with an all-out attempt to integrate Birmingham, where a vicious white power structure had kept the city totally segregated. Blacks were denied any kind of job except mop-up and servitude. Every public place was splattered with insulting signs above drinking fountains and lunch counters and on the doors of toilets and changing rooms and stores. The Southern Christian Leadership Council, headed by Martin Luther King, was sponsoring it, and Talbot answered the call. The press covered it like a war. The TV and photo images went everywhere. The world saw children clubbed down by water cannons, arm-biting canines snarling in peaceful faces, and the photo of a policeman's knee on the neck of a woman on the pavement while the voices of children singing hymns drifted from the windows of jails. At first, Talbot was a walkie-talkie coordinator on the streets. He carried a photo in his wallet of a man who had lead-piped his knee in case he ever ran into him again. When organizers learned how quickly and how well he could write, he was assigned to leaflets, press releases, and emergency communiques to the Justice Department. They were crazy days. He wrote and wrote and wrote, morning till midnight. He kept a diary and even found time for verse. After 34 days of demos and thousands of arrests, Talbot flew back to New York with the manuscript of his first book of poems. Everybody thought Talbot would be asked to speak at the Great March. He wrote a poem for it and practiced its recitation secretly every day, with the prospect of hundreds of thousands in the audience. The number of people who lunged for the microphone is vast, and there was no space for Talbot's poem. Talbot laughed about it, but his friends were upset. Talbot returned from the speaker's platform with a tale of censorship. The larger the crowd, the greater the control over text, and he'd been disgusted, watching one of the speakers at a portable typewriter backstage having to rewrite his speech. The speaker had wanted to criticize the Kennedy administration's appointment of racist federal judges in the South, and he'd attacked Kennedy's civil rights bill, too, as too weak and too late. President Kennedy had given a televised speech on June 11th about civil rights. Next day, NAACP leader Medgar Evers was murdered in Jackson, Mississippi. On June 19th, Kennedy submitted the Civil Rights Bill to Congress. Kennedy brothers initially opposed the Great March, fearing it would harm the bill's chances. A group of march leaders met at the White House and cooled it out. There was a general agreement. There was a general agreement that the march would be creative lobbying, would spare the administration harsh criticism, and Kennedy agreed to support it. It was bullshit. Waffling liberal bullshit, Talbot complained. I have a copy. They didn't want him to say the truth, namely that Kennedy has appointed racist federal judges in the South, and the Civil Rights Bill is too weak and too late. It's a plate of dry, powdery, undercooked liberal biscuits in a cracked plate. There was a demo lull about then, some uninspiring speeches, and Sam handed out his magazine and walked around the Peace Tree, shooting a few three-minute rolls with his 16mm Bell and Howell. When Mahalia Jackson began singing, "I've been buked and I've been scorned," Talbot came over to Sam. "King is next." Sam had never heard Martin King speak. He was prepared to sneer, expecting the sort of preacherly pralines he'd heard in church after church in the South on civil rights marches. He had never considered a voice as an empowering instrument, but never had such a speech been spoken. It was Blake's voice of the bar that passed in present seas. It brought the hot masses there that day into the finest sort of unity. Up above the speaker's platform, you could see the huge seated statue of Lincoln. Sam's skin began to tingle, to twinge, to crawl with buzzies. By the middle of the speech, Sam and his friends were standing in a semicircle beneath the Peace Tree, holding hands. Sam, Rebecca Levy, Cynthia Pruitt, John Barrett, Louise Adams, Claudia Pred, Talbot the Great, Nelson Sait, and pals from the Living Theater, the Committee for a Nonviolent World, and the Catholic Worker. Sam looked around, wishing he could touch every hand in the multitude from the 20 corners of the U.S., and spotted a group of men scampering among the demonstrators. They would stop briefly and bend down above those who were sitting, and then make strange, quick, jerking motions against their own noses with their hands. What was going on? The group came closer, and Sam saw the white circles with black swastikas on their armbands. They passed the Peace Tree. One Nazi was making soft spitting sounds and cursing them in a whisper, his hand tracing elongated Rhine lines with two fingers pressed together. Everybody was listening to King, and no one wanted to be distracted. Sam was angry. He couldn't remain passive when the hellmen of the ovens were cursing those he loves. They had to be confronted. He hoisted his camera upon his shoulder, just as King's voice said, "Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of that old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty." Oh, we're free at last. King finished, and the roar of a mile-wide seashell began as the oven man scampered away. Talbot and Nelson rushed after one knot of them, Sam another. Sam thought of Ezra Pound as he trotted after the oven men, Pound who had helped him become a poet, Pound on whom he had once relied for strength and ideas on creative rebellion, Pound who had let him down in the Library of Congress. "I learned something very important from you, Ez," Sam said under his breath, pausing to film a fly-fotted armband. He shouted at the Nazis in a mode a bit unmindful of the spirit of Gandhian non-violence. "Hey, Nazi puss! Do you know you're scum? Come here, I got something for you, you filthy puke." Those words seemed sufficient to cause them to turn around and converge on Sam. His camera caught it all. "Death to Nazi death worms!" That brought forth the boots. Sam rolled on the ground to protect his guts and his camera. His kidneys, unfortunately, were exposed, and one of the oven men got him. Another raised his boot to break his rib, so Sam twisted up to his feet. By that time, the park police were there, and the oven men rushed to split, with several getting nabbed. Sam kept shouting at them. He tried to recall the Quaker adage, something like "the spirit of reconciliation is an overwhelming thing," but however much part of him wanted to transform the armbands, part of him clearly wanted to knife them. He couldn't remember the words. He was separated from his friends when he followed the policeman leading the Nazis away. "You Nazi barfnarls! You Nazi garbage!" He was following too closely. The police warned him, and one of the ovens lunged at the camera, and then Sam, too, was under arrest. His friend Cynthia Pruitt had been keeping watch on him, and they let him hand her camera
Harris camera and satchel, for which he was mightily grateful, not wanting the fresh copies of Dope Fucking and Social Change, a Journal of the New America, falling into the files of the fuzz. To Sam, surrounded by Nazis and under arrest, Cynthia was a vision of paradise. She was barefoot, her jeans frayed into dangling white grass at the cuffs, her shirt tied up halter-like in the heat, a canteen hooked upon one of the belt loops of her jeans. Her hair was safely caught up and wrapped around with a bandana, the emergency gas mask of the era. For a moment, their wild eyes met. He would never forget her smile and the chipped left edge of her left front tooth she hadn't the scratch to repair. She bent down and Sam saw for a flash her beautiful nipples as she picked up his light green campaign hat where it had fallen. She donned it and its red and white ahimsa button seemed to calm him. Sam went limp and the two cops carried him. He let his head drift back to a sudden upside-down view of the Washington Monument. The white-gray obelisk looked like a stark ultra-realistic painting, the outer edges forming a double line of white that bent together at the top against the milky blue of the air like long, thin strokes of titanium white made with a palette knife. While they carried him, he focused on the two dark observation windows at the summit of the monument, which for one startling second looked like the eye holes in a sky-sized clan robe. Years later, he could still vividly recall that startling vision of the giant clan robe, and with the perspective of time, he saw that there was actually something like a giant clan robe that tried to blot out the fair weather of America in 1963. Sam Thomas was wadded up and stuffed into the paddy wagon. Before they shut the door came another startling vision. It was the hovering face of secret policeman J. Edgar Hoover spread across the sky like a dead carp at the mouth of a sewer. Sam saw a time of crazed peril for America. There was the crackle of insane electricity in the brains of madmen and planes swooping low over villages with fires that would not stop. That was the opening story of the second volume of Ed Sanders' Tales of Beaten and Glory. These are tales of the 60s, retold in the 70s by Ed Sanders. I mean, I don't know who's listening or who cares. Anyways, you know, he's up there, Ed Sanders. He's hanging out with all those guys, Frank Zappa, Allen Ginsberg. You know, all those guys. Bill Ox, Ted Berrigan, the whole crew, you know. I mean, they all crossed paths. It wasn't a lot of people. And then it was also. So I don't really have time to go on any further. Maybe I'll just get about to read an entire story. I'll read from the introduction. Which is really introduction for part one, because it's not true of part two. But they're short, they're stories, but they're linked, so recurring characters, but some are not. Anyways, he says these stories are set in the Lower East Side of New York City, where I lived from 1960 to 1970. They're arranged chronologically and trace the interconnected lives from the late 50s through the first half of the 60s of a group of poets, writers, painters, musicians, radicals, freedom riders, anti-war activists, and partisans of the beat struggle in America. This was written at a time when I guess he was scared to say that a lot of them were homosexuals too, and only a few of them were brown. But there were brown people, and for white people to hang around brown people and homosexuals at that time period, you know. It was a very intense decade in Lower East Side, and I was in the middle of it as a publisher of countless mimeographed tracts and literary magazines, and as the founder of the Peaceside Bookstore, a cultural center and scrounge lounge popular in the day. It was at the Peaceside Bookstore that Thule Kupferberg and I organized in late 64 the folk rock ensemble of poets known as the Bugs. I think they're most famous for that song, Happy Together. Oh no, that was the Turtles. Sorry. I moved down the Lower East Side at the end of a frenetic 10 years. In 1973, this has been Goodnight Norman, and tonight you heard from Tales of Beatnik Glory by Ed Sanders.